Hello.
Hey,
hello.
Who's there?
It's Craig on the line. Craig McKee.
Hi, Craig. Craig, it's Ken Freeland, and Dan is here with us, right, Dan?
James.
Oh, James, hey.
Yeah,
Ken and Craig here, and Dan.
Robin.
Hello, Robin.
Yeah, I just got in.
Okay.
Robin, were those buttons I sent helpful?
Yeah, thank you very much, James. I forgot to mention that last time.
Did people
the
appreciate
product
those?
This way is slowly going out the door, so I like
Okey-doke. It. Okey-doke, great.
Hello.
Hi, who's here?
Hello.
Hi, who's just joining, Paul?
Yeah,
hi,
Paul's around. Hello, I'm not hearing anything.
Well, there's about five of us on the line right now.
Okay, fine.
Jim Fetzer's not here yet, is he?
Who?
Jim Fetzer?
No. Sure. I don't think so.
It'll be a lonely call without him. Does anybody have Jim Fetzer's telephone number?
No.
I don't. I have his email.
Well, we can go through approval of minutes and agenda and go to the second item of the agenda until he comes.
Yep. I guess we'll have to do that because it's already 7 past the hour, so we don't want to waste any more time. Okay. Craig, you want to take the roll call?
Yeah, okay, why doesn't, I think I've got like 5 of us on here, but why don't people tell me the names of who's on, sort of one by one, and I'll make sure I've got everybody.
James, Robin Horton here.
Robin Horton
here.
Robin Horton? Okay.
Paul's
I got Paul, yeah, and I got Ken.
James.
And Dan, which Dan are we talking about?
James.
Oh, James, sorry. Wasn't there a Dan as well?
There was a Dan on earlier, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Dan, you're not here anymore? I guess we lost him.
Which Dan was that?
It was like Dan Sutton or something like that. I didn't catch the last name.
Yeah, Sutton is this. Yeah, Dan Sutton. Yeah. So, yeah. So there's 5 of us right now.
Okay, we'll go ahead and call the roll of the people you have, Craig. If nobody else wants
okay.
to either here, then we'll go on.
Okay, so what I have is Ken Freeland, Rob Horton, Craig McKee, Paul Zaremka, James Hubbard. That's what I got.
Anybody else on the line? Okay, then. Let's move on to approval of last month's minutes. Any need for amendment of those?
This is Robin here with a question.
Yeah, go ahead, Rob.
I'm not sure if this is doable or this is new information, but the on the minutes where Paul Zaremka offered us some conclusions from the Toronto hearings, which is an important part. In the meantime, I've been able to finish reading the book, the Toronto hearings, and Paul is represented beautifully there and very appropriately patted on the back, okay, by some of the commissioners or whomever those guys, whatever they're called, and represents well. And somehow I would like to put in either last, to revise last minutes to add something on or add something to this week's point of view that notes the fact that we were very supportive in trying to reach out when Paul was accepted and then excluded, and then we and others stood up to get him re-included, and that is, I feel, an accomplishment by this, some of the people on this teleconference. More importantly, he's a dedicated person on the conference, and I just think, you know, we need to put a little feather in our hat, and also just, you know, say thank you, as I am, to Paul for doing what he did.
Well, yeah, that's not going to be able to go on last week's minutes because that was not part of last week's conversation. But if you want to make a request to include that in this week's minutes, you could do that, and then we could go from there.
Okay, great. Then, Craig, you're listening here. I mean, I've stated that we should do towards the end, a new business or something like that. And so that's pretty clear. So.
Yeah,
if you want to just add those then, that would be fine.
Wait a minute. Hold on. That's really
open discussion.
We have to be fair to the people that were on the last call. All we're doing right now is making sure that the minutes of the last conference were accurate. Okay. If there's anything else that needs to be added, that should really come up as a new business item. Okay. And we can do that when we get to the agenda formation. All right. You want to. Okay. So, Craig, didn't we get a response from somebody that said that they were listed as being on that call, but they weren't there or something like that, or was that the previous call?
I think that was last month. I think last month I listed Dwayne, and he wasn't on the call, so. But not this time, I don't think.
Okay. All right. So, hearing no requests for amendment, we'll take the minutes for approved and move on to tonight's agenda formation. It was supposed to be largely Jim Fetzer and talking about where we go from here with respect to hearings and so forth, but Jim has not graced us yet with his presence, so the agenda is open for suggestions. Does anyone have any?
Well, maybe just go to the open discussion.
James, you had an idea for something you wanted to discuss, wasn't it, tonight?
Well, I did, but I think I took it more in perspective of something that Dwayne had posted about what that character from Veterans Today had made a gross exaggeration in a column.
Excuse me, who just joined the call?
Yes, I'm sorry, I'm late. It's Ned Delaney.
Ned, hi. Okay. Ned Delaney, Craig.
Well, I didn't hear the name, sorry.
Ned Delaney?
Oh, Ned Delaney. Got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think I'm excited about that as I was.
Okay. So then I guess we'll just move into open discussion format if nobody has any particular items of interest to focus us on. If that's agreeable to everybody, let's just move right into open discussion. This would be a good time, Robin, if you want to make your comment and ask you to be recorded.
Okay, what I would like to do is, in the open discussion part here, is just make a point that if you haven't read the Toronto hearings yet, the fact that Paul, you know, was first accepted, then rejected, Paul Zaremko was first accepted, then rejected, and then one way or another, we helped a little bit anyways at getting him back associated with the Toronto hearings. I think is a little feather in our cap. I feel very proud of it, because if you haven't read the 9/11 Toronto hearings yet and see what Paul presented, it is it's very powerful element of the entire book anyways, and I feel good about that. So I think that we should acknowledge him and acknowledge our small role in helping him get back in it, because I certainly complained.
Any discussion of that request that be noted in our minutes? Is there anybody opposed to the idea of that statement being included in our minutes? Craig, do you think you can encapsulate it, or do we need it repeated?
I think so. I mean, it's a thank you to Paul for his work with the hearings, but also an acknowledgement of the contribution that the teleconference made in lobbying for his inclusion in the hearings. Is that a fair way to put it?
That is also a recommendation, Craig, that anybody who hasn't read the book yet should.
Okay.
All right. Does anybody disagree with that recommendation? If not, then I think Craig has it, and we can move on to other discussion items. Anybody have any?
Okay, well, this is Paul. I just want to thank Robin for mentioning that. Robin, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Paul. Believe me.
You're welcome.
I do have a kind of a question. This is Robin, a kind of a question on where we're standing with the teleconference. And, you know, I know that Mark had been involved he's not so much anymore. So are we still sort of operating with a loose connection with the JFK and the flyby thing, or are we standing a little bit different now? I don't know. I'm asking the question.
Anybody want to respond to that, or should I respond? I'll give you my best response to that, Robin. I think we sort of agreed to be seized of the question, in a sense, that we agreed that it was a matter of relevance and to be pursued, but we didn't take any particular position with respect to it, is the way I would summarize it. I think it was pretty much agreed that we should take advantage of the anniversary of the JFK assassination in whatever way we could to promote 9/11 truth via it, but no particular direction was agreed to.
And the other half, the flyby, which is what, the 12, 21, 12 thing, or something like that, I don't know. The moon landing stuff?
I don't think there was any consensus around that. No, I don't recall any. Does anyone else?
Okay, thanks.
No.
If I'm going to keep talking because I got to list a few things here. If you want, I got a.
Go ahead. Open forum.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the Million Muslim March that might be coming up on 9/11/13. Another subject would be kind of jumping the gun or adding to what I would have added to if Fetzer were here, and that is the future of 9/11, not truth conferences, okay? I have an issue with that because I've been trying to somehow figure out a way to meld the peace community and the 9/11 truth community. So that's the way that I see the future, and I'd be really interested in anybody's point of view on that. And then, I guess I have an announcement, and that is just that Ken Jenkins and I are nearing completion on a compilation DVD that actually ties in all of the subjects that, you know, I've just kind of shared with you about peace and the 9/11 truth community, and we can talk about that later. Now, I was going to ask Fetzer, air traffic control, question about his position about the video fakery surrounding the two World Trade Center towers, and maybe the hologram, are we in hologram or whatever? I'm not sure where he was going to go. But I was going to ask him an ATC question, and that ATC question would be, how does he deal with the fact that trained professionals in the Newark Tower, air traffic controllers, who are, trust me on this, okay, very well trained daily to recognize aircraft, who a bunch of them saw what most people think, even if it wasn't United 175, they definitely saw an aircraft, you know, go across the Verrazano Bridge and whack WTC-2. So I was going to ask him that question. So pretty clear professional evidence on that. That's it for me.
Well, that's quite a plethora of interesting topics. Does anybody care to respond to any of them?
Robin,
I'd like to ask you if you could elaborate a little bit more on the Million Muslim March. I haven't heard anything about that, and I'd like to learn more about it.
Yes. I got it somehow on one of my email lists and did some research and did some recommendations on it. I don't really have a good connection for it or a link to it right now, but I do believe that Kevin Barrett, one way or another, is sort of involved in trying to stir this thing up. And I think it's a great opportunity because, yeah, I'm speaking completely for myself right now. I really would love to have a million Muslim 9/11 Truth for Peace activists on our side. I am, I can't speak any more about the national movement and where that assembly is going. I was hoping to see if anybody else heard anything about that. I just had a short message that came my way. I will give you some background that's very disturbing to me, and that is in 2010, I was down in New York City at a bunch of events that the New York groups put together. And they ended up a very nice segment of the panels that included the Muslim community. And unfortunately, this whole event, I think, started out by Bukowski. The event ended up being taped by, I think, an independent news network, INN. But nobody else could tape it. Nobody, you know, they had the exclusive rights and some type of trade-off. So all of the video that was taken on that was fundamentally buried, and it was good stuff. So that really annoyed me. So when this concept about the Million Muslim March came up, and their basic thing was to deal with Islamophobia more so than 9/11. 9/11 was a backseat player in this. So in any event, I've seen a big resistance in the 9/11 Truth community, from the Muslim community, because they just they're worried about the typical branding of them, along with the branding of us as tinfoil hatters, doing more damage to their cause than helping their cause. So I have really been looking forward to this and can't wait. And I personally am working with the local Seattle Muslim community in trying to share with them and deal with them in their reluctance to be public about it. So the Million Muslim March would obviously be public, and then we have some 9/11 truth activities that can sort of come out. And I have developed a phenomenal new thing for dispensing the DVDs that I'll talk about, the compilation DVD, and I definitely have handed a couple hundred experts, explosive evidence experts speak out. I call it a push-pin tactic, where I make a copy of the DVD, put a little sticker on it, buy a paper jacket, put the big word free on it, and take a push-pin and start to push-pin these in local areas where people shop, coffee shops, you know, wherever there's a public posting board. And I'm able, because of my weekly route of just doing my little jobs and grocery shopping, to drop by, you know, at least once a week. And I'll push pin about, you know, anywhere between 2 and 5 copies up, and they go. Man, I come back 3-4 days later, and they're gone. So I find this to be very effective, especially, I think, in the grocery store areas, because everybody has to shop. And people can take these things without having to, quote, confront, you know, a 9/11 truther and expose themselves to what they're afraid of, which is governmental scrutiny or societal scrutiny. So in any event, I was going to try to encourage the local Muslim community, once Ken Jenkins and I get through this compilation DVD that circles everything, okay? War, peace, false flag attacks, anthrax, dancing Israelis, family story with the Press for Truth short edition, racial Corey story, kind of a circular thing with the military-industrial complex to just show how it all kind of comes together. And it's basically, it takes advantage of the fact that Gage's latest work, Experts Speak Out, is a vehicle to decouple Islam from the 9/11 attacks. And I want to make sure that's big. So that's sort of where I'm at. So if you guys hear about that or anything, just chip in. They're going to be looking for guidance or whatever. My guess is that they won't get 1 million Muslims in Washington, D.C. I don't care for that. I'll take 20 of them in the Puget Sound on a nice day, and we'll get more done than those 1 million people will get done. So that's that.
Hi, this is Paul. I can make some comments on the JFK thread.
Go ahead, Paul.
I've just been introduced to, I haven't read it yet, but there's a book by Wayne Madsen, which was published last July. And he spent, and I'm going to have to give you, it's going to take me a few minutes to tell you what the bottom line is here. But let me just start with the fact that he spent several months in Indonesia. Now, why did he go to Indonesia? He went to Indonesia because it turns out that if you know anything about the history of Indonesia, it was one of the most extreme U.S. supported repressions since World War II. I mean, we talking about 500,000 to 1 million people being basically intentionally assassinated. What does this matter about 9/11? It turns out that JFK was sympathetic to Sukarno, who was the premier or the president, I'm not sure which, of Indonesia since its independence from the Dutch up until Kennedy was assassinated. In fact, Kennedy had planned to visit Indonesia at Sukarno's request or invitation in February of 1964, after Sukarno had visited the White House. I think it was 1962. I may have the year wrong. But anyway, he considered Kennedy a great friend. Now, that's the background. The next step to learn is that Obama's mother, okay, so now we get to the present, okay, Obama's mother, according to this book, was a CIA agent, and her first husband was the first, and this is now the Kenyan husband, the first husband was the, I don't know if you know, but Russia had something called a friendship university where they invited people from Africa to attend university in Moscow. And so the CIA wanted to do something similar in the United States, so they started to recruit people from Africa to come to various places. One of the places was the East-West Center. all this is connected by, you know, it sounds like I'm going off to the deep end here, but I'm not, okay? It's connected to the East-West Center in Honolulu, and that's where Obama's mother was at and where she met her first husband, who was the very first person coming from Africa to the East-West Center under the, I think it's under the Ford Foundation, if I remember correctly. Anyway, he doesn't play such a big role because they only stay married 3 years, but in that interval, they had gone to Indonesia. They got divorced for reasons I don't know anything about, but the second husband of Obama's mother was a military officer also a high military officer who's Indonesian and who also had deep, I guess, CIA connections and was directly involved in the coup against Sukarno in 1965, okay? So what you have here is both of Obama's parents are the parents and the stepfather are both heavily connected to the CIA and heavily connected to the most murderous operation that the United States did in the post-World War II period. That doesn't mean that Obama was direct. I mean, he was too young, obviously. But some of the other factors that come involved in this is that Obama he was living in Indonesia, and under Indonesian rules, the child of a foreign child cannot attend public school in Indonesia. So they had to change his name to Barry, and I can't remember the last name, Barry something.
Soweto.
Soweto.
I think it's Satoru.
Okay.
Oh, really?
Satoru.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe so.
So they changed his name, and when he comes back to Honolulu and goes to high school, he graduates with that name. With that name, he's given under the sponsorship, apparently, of Kissinger. I think it's Brzezinski. I'm not sure which one. Brzezinski, given a trip to go to Afghanistan and Pakistan. So when he comes back, he goes to Occidental College in L.A. This is now his first 2 years in undergraduate education, which apparently Occidental College is known as a CIA conduit college. I didn't know that myself, but I'm just reporting, okay? And from there, he goes to Columbia, and Columbia, Brzezinski is his advisor. So there's a deep connection of Obama to this whole Indonesian scenario, which was a major factor behind the massacre that occurred in Indonesia in 1965. I guess the message is that tells me, at least as I listen to it, tells me a lot why Obama would go to Egypt in the first year of his presidency and dump on the 9/11 movement in a very stark way. That's all I have to say right at this point. I just got introduced to this whole theme.
Okay. Does anybody besides me want to respond to Paul?
Robin will say a few words.
Robin and then myself? Go ahead, Rob.
Well, you know, turns out, through my odd life, two of my kids went to the Ivy Leagues, one Columbia, one Harvard, and they're both CIA. They developed CIA, FBI assets, and the major people who work in the financial industry in both of those colleges. The Ivy Leagues are the problem in this country, not the solution. And there's just no doubt about that, and there's no doubt, I'm not an Obama fan, and there is no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans as far as I'm concerned. And so Obama, when he went to Harvard, okay, he didn't earn anything at Harvard. He was put into the position, and the quid pro quo was, you know, we can't get the lefties to vote. We need somebody different, and it had to be a woman, like I call a pasty. You know, they were finished with Kerry and Gore and Dukakis, who I might call pasty white guys. So they needed a pasty black guy or a pasty woman. And so there you got Hillary and you got Obama. So bottom line of the story is the game is rigged. It has been, will be quite some time for, you know, the top down.
Okay. First of all, Paul, I'd like to ask that you will send the link to this story to Craig for publication along with the note that it was discussed.
Well, the link is the book, but I can do, sure, I can do that.
Oh, it's a book. Okay, I misunderstood. I thought you were getting this off a website.
Well,
what's the name of the book?
If you give me a second, I can find it out while we're online. I'll just
look. Okay. Well, the second thing I want to ask you is, first of all, everything you've said strikes me as extremely plausible. The problem is, for me personally, and this is just me, is the source,
yeah.
Okay? I have run into stuff by Wayne Mattson before and found it very interesting but also very problematic. And I've never met anybody that's ever met Wayne Mattson. I don't know who he is or anything about him. Do you know anything about Wayne Mattson?
No, I mean, I've never met him. I probably am similar to you. I mean, I don't know. I've sort of respected what he's done over the years as a genuinely independent journalist. In this particular case, what I understand, I haven't bought the book yet. I'm going to buy it, but I understand he spent months in Indonesia interviewing everybody he possibly could who might have known Barry, whatever the name you guys told me it is. So that sounded like a pretty convincing kind of thing to
do. Well, you know, I'm just playing devil's advocate here now, but does
anybody know
anybody that knows Wayne Mattson? Does anybody know anybody that has known him personally, that's ever talked to him or, you know, has contact with him?
This is Robin. I have.
Oh, yeah? You do?
Yeah, I bumped into Wayne Mattson a couple of times up in Seattle and back on 2010 in New York City. And he's a major player in kind of exposing some of the whole dancing Israeli stories, yet he's sort of kind of backed off on it. And who Mattson is he used to be an intelligence asset in Washington, D.C., and he's one of the famous people that we have who, you know, has inside information with the big quotes around it. And my feeling is that Mattson is a person who dispenses information that our honorable, dishonorable, I should say, opposition sort of wants out. So he's a very sophisticated gatekeeper. But in the end, I still want to read what he writes because we're digging into this slowly but surely, and the powers to be simply have to start to accept some of the exposure while still, okay, trying to do the best they can to deflect the exposure of the real people behind the scenes. I happen to be reading Baker's Family of Secrets right now, and the same thing about the Kennedy stuff is coming out regarding the Bush family and JFK and Indonesia, as Paul just happened to call. So I like Wayne. I'm glad he does what he does, but you make sure you have your salt shaker on your table.
The title of the book is The Manufacturing of a President, the CIA's Insertion of Barack H. Obama Jr., I don't know why Jr., maybe it's true, into the White House.
Well, you know, when you take a look at how Clinton got to the thing, and you take a look at MENA, Arkansas, and his engagement with drug running into Central America and the CIA ops, he was a made man because he didn't blow the whistle, so they had to put him in the presidency. That's what I see. So all of the presidents since they off JFK have been approved by the CIA first. Simple.
Particularly Gerald Ford.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
Well, he was a Kissinger man. He was straight out from Kissinger, yeah.
Same deal.
Yeah.
So we're getting there.
And the reason why I brought it up, I didn't even think of bringing it up until you mentioned the peace movement, you know.
Right.
And yeah, okay.
Right, absolutely, yep. So, I mean, you know, and if you, you know, if you want to just expand a little bit, there's, it is very clear to me, and we all probably on this phone call know, and if you don't, you will in a minute, that the existing peace communities, there are two major elements about the historic peace communities that are real. Number one, admitted to, they had been infiltrated for years by our opposition to make them behave in ways that they were certainly not peaceful and to destroy themselves, which is to continually be, you know, come to our march and we'll do civil disobedience. Well, people don't want to do that. So the demise of the peace communities is not by accident. That has been very well executed by counterintelligence. And then the second thing is we should all know that there were people from the 9/11 truth community who were indeed meeting at the higher levels of the various peace communities who call their home base Washington, D.C., and they were specifically, deliberately, and intentionally told to avoid the 9/11 truth community because of this, that, and the other thing. And there is a common denominator between the demise of the peace communities and the demise and the undermining of the 9/11 truth community, and that is the nexus there is Palestine. And the peace communities of the last three or four decades were dusted up because they had factions within it that started to fight themselves about should we include Palestine in the discussion of Israel, and half of them said yes, half of them said no, and they just fought each other to nowhere. And obviously, anybody who's done any work on 9/11 recognizes that Israel does not want the discussion of the dancing Israelis or the possibility of Israel's role in the events of 9/11 to be discussed. And I'm not saying that they were, and I'm not defining what role they did have. I'm not that educated enough. All I'm saying, there's an absolute symmetry between why the peace communities in this country failed and some of the struggles we've had in the 9/11 truth community to get our story out. And that is I'm just going to say to Zionists or Israel or whatever, they just don't want to discuss 9/11 and they don't really want to discuss peace. Because the bottom line of the story is simple. If the United States of America is not at war, a viable peace community is going to start to talk about war and occupation in other parts of the world. And obviously that would lead to Israel and Palestine, and that's not to be on the agenda on anything in the United States. And Craig, Canada. So that's why.
This is Ken. Yeah, this is Ken. Robin, I think those were some extremely incisive comments that you just made, and I think it goes, we have to say that it goes even further than that in this respect, that Israel not only does not want, the Zionist community, I should say, not only does not want Israel's role in 9/11 discussed, they do not want 9/11 truth discussed, period. And the proof of this is with Cynthia McKinney's testimony that whenever she tried to raise the issue of 9/11, and she was not raising Israel's role in it, she was just raising the question of what happened, it was the Zionists who gave her the hard time, not anybody else. Okay? So
I agree with you, Ken. And if you deal with local levels of the peace communities, you will find people who aren't considered necessarily to be Zionists, okay, and who are sort of normal peace activists to be saying the mantra and following those rules. They just shout it out. They're the second worst group of people that I run into in the streets about educating into the 9/11 truth community. The first group is the Rush Limbaugh complete crazy nut cases. Second worst group is our, quotes, progressive peace communities. They're shut down.
Well, Robin, as somebody who has a long experience in local peace organizations, I have to say that what you're saying is absolutely valid, but there's a parallel. First of all, it was exactly as you're describing, that the issue of Palestine was suppressed for the longest time by the peace community in general and the left in particular. But then the 9/11 issue just followed suit. I mean, it was done the same kind of way. It was
same
really
deal.
Just, you know, yeah. Yeah, that's my experience, exactly.
9/11 and the evaluation of the occupation of Palestine, both those two lead one way or another to evaluating Palestine and Israel, both of them. And they both had to be shut down. And when you take a look at it, you will find, and I just slam my friends in San Francisco because they're totally, totally infiltrated, okay? Because they're in our country, the one city that should be melding 9/11 truth and peace is San Francisco, but they've been infiltrated, and they don't. Thank God for San Diego. They're doing such a good job down there. That's because of the military.
This is Jim joining you. I'm very sorry that I was late. I was delayed. I'm
sorry.
Hey, Jim.
Oh, well, better late than never. Hi, Jim.
Yeah.
Well, we've just had a very scintillating discussion, Jim. I'm sorry you missed it, but I'm glad you're back. And I think now that you're here, we ought to just turn the discussion to the direction of, giving you an opportunity to complete anything you wanted to from last week, but most importantly, talking about how you see the future of 9/11 Truth teleconferences after Vancouver.
Well, I sure am grateful that you featured me at the last conference, and I'm delighted to be back as much to answer any questions you may have as to add new contributions. I do want to emphasize that it's entirely possible that new information, new evidence, new alternatives may lead to further revisions yet in the most likely explanation for how the Twin Towers were destroyed. Though I think it's most unlikely that any new evidence is going to have any significant impact on the conclusions that we drew about no Boeing 757 having hit the Pentagon, about all of the crash sites having been fabricated or faked, albeit in different ways, and that the American neocons, supporters of Project for the New American Century, together with the Mossad, were the principal proponents of and implementers of and beneficiaries of 9/11. So I think before I were to add anything, I'd like to open the floor to questions, anything you may have to ask about, for example, the whole business about no planes, which even fairly sophisticated members of 9/11 seem not to quite understand.
Yeah, Robin Horton has put in a reservation to ask you a question on just that subject, so let's give him the floor, and then we can go from there. Go ahead, Robin.
Hi, Jim. How you doing? Thanks for showing up here. Generally, you know, as you may remember that I'm an air traffic controller, so when I get some radar data and I take a look at the transcripts and the way that air traffic control and NORAD and other facilities interrelate, that's sort of speaking my language. And before I go ahead, what I want to say to you and everybody is that when we get information from the United States government, it doesn't matter whether it's from the FAA or from the Pentagon, or intelligence sources, any organization or agency, we should be very, very skeptical of it, and I am. However, Jim, the information that I've gotten from some of the radar tracks, pretty much other than American 77, give me some confidence that indeed there were real airplanes and that the aircraft behaved the way they did, again, with the exception of American 77. And one of the specific questions that I wanted to deal with regarding especially United 175 or what is alleged to be 175 is that what comes out to me in my continuing research is that the air traffic controllers at the Newark Tower, who are actually in the tower, not using the radar, several of them went to the southeast window, and they observed an aircraft crossing at a high speed, descending over the Verrazano Bridge and into the World Trade Center 2. And I know that there's a bit of evidence that's coming up about, I don't know, video fakery, hologram, I'm not even sure. Okay. But the bottom line of the story is these guys are like pros. They see these aircraft every day, all the time. That's what they do. How do you deal with that?
Robin, have you read any of my stuff?
I've read some of it, not all of it, Jim.
Yeah, it's clear because you're contradicting, for example, even the findings of pilots who established that Flight 93 was in the air that day, but it was over Champaign-Urbana after it had allegedly crashed in Shanksville. And
that's,
that flight, and
that's
flight,
that's,
Robin,
that's,
Robin,
Jim, that's,
Robin.
That's by ACARS. Jim, you can't tell me something that is fact when I don't believe that it is, okay? That's
well, I don't care what you believe is
Listen,
fact.
Robin, let him answer, and then you can come back, okay? Let him answer, and then you can come back and re-question him, okay?
Normally governmental sources aren't supposed to be reliable, and we know that practically everything we've been told about 9/11 from the government is false, provably false, and frequently not even physically possible in the sense it violates laws of physics, of engineering, and of aerodynamics. In the case of the Bureau of Transportation Statistics records showing that flights 11 and 77 weren't even scheduled to fly that day, this is a kind of very credible evidence because it contradicts the government's official account. It's the government's own evidence contradicting the government's own account. Very analogous to when the NTSB investigated the crash of the plane that took the life of Senator Paul Wellstone, his wife, daughter, three aides, and the two pilots. They did a simulation in Florida of a plane with a slightly weaker engine, programmed it with the same flight conditions, weather conditions, and all that, flew it abnormally slow, and could not cause the plane to crash. Now, the government's contention in that case was that the pilots had simply neglected their airspeed and altitude and allowed the plane to crash. But when they tried to simulate the conditions, they weren't able to do it. Now, Robin, I don't know exactly what to tell you, but it seems to me that you ought to know that on my account, there was a visible image for both the north and the south towers. In the case of the south tower, when you do a frame-by-frame analysis, it doesn't look at all like a Boeing 767. I've laid this out. I've explained it in my articles. In the case of 175, it looks a great deal like a 767, but as pilots have established, it's flying too fast for a Boeing 767, and its entry into the towers violates all of Newton's laws of motion. It enters completely from its nose to its tail in the same number of frames, it passes through its nose to its tail in air. And if you want to believe that an airplane can maintain precisely the same velocity in encountering a 500,000-ton building intersecting eight different floors, each of which consists of a steel truss filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete, and not diminish in its velocity, well, then you're in a different universe than I. The point I also make about that is the plane obviously should have crumpled on impact. Its engines might have passed through the floors. The windows are only very narrow and represent less than 25% of the area of the facade, but most of the plane would have remained external to the building. Its wings would have broken off, its tail, body, seats, and luggage fallen to the ground. None of that happened. We already know we're not witnessing a real event. Something is wrong. In addition, it should have exploded on impact, but the perps needed to get the plane all the way into the building before it exploded to create a pseudoscientific explanation for what they would describe as the collapse of the building. Well, the building manifestly is not collapsing. It's blowing apart in every direction from the top down. All the floors remain stationary. They're being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, and when it's over, the buildings have been destroyed below ground level. This was no collapse. This was carefully staged. They actually had exploded. It had enormous explosions in sub-basements of both the north and the south tower in order to drain the sprinkler systems of water so they could not extinguish the very modest fires that would remain after the spectacular fireballs. They had to coordinate the planes hitting the building with those explosions in the sub-basement so they could maintain, falsely of course, but maintain that it was falling jet fuel through the elevator shafts that caused those explosions. Not only did Willie Rodriguez report them, but Gordon Rawkins and Craig Furlong undertook very exacting research about this, including studying the seismic data from a Lamont laboratory run by Columbia University and comparing it with FAA and radar data, and found that those explosions actually occurred 14 and 17 seconds before the alleged impacts of the planes with the building. Now, if you're going to come on here and criticize me with screwy complaints that don't address the arguments I've given, then that's shame on you, Robin. I've heard things about you that have not instilled confidence in me, and I'm not surprised that you're showing up here unprepared to deal with the issues as I have articulated them.
Actually, I'm quite prepared, Jim. Thank you. And you did good work on Wellstone. I made it all the way through all of that stuff. So in answer to my question about the air traffic controllers seeing something, they did see something. So we kind of agree on that term. And also, I personally, as an air traffic controller, have operated turbojet aircraft years ago that flew at speeds well above their placarded measurements. And a pilot for 9/11 Truth's entire... Jim, I will have the floor.
Yeah, yeah.
Pilot,
Jim,
pilots for 9/11 Truth's entire story about excessive speeds is eviscerated by the fact that a Boeing 727 back a while ago, TWA, okay, pilots did something wrong, ended up in a high-speed descent that reached Mach 1.2. Okay, before they were able to dirty it up and get it back under control. So the bottom line of the story is that the pilot's story about excessive speeds are eviscerated. All the stuff about the building performance, okay, I'm sort of in tune on. I asked one simple question, and because my analysis and my point of view and the circumstance, regardless of what you heard, is that I am satisfied at the moment, other than American 77, that all three of the other aircraft were who they were, and they did what they did. Where I stand.
That's quite a ridiculous position. Anyone who's looked at Shanksville knows that no Boeing 757 crashed at Shanksville. Even the first two reporters on the scene both said the eerie aspect that the crash site was that there was no evidence any plane had crashed there. The coroner reported he ceased being coroner after 15 minutes because there were no body parts. He never even saw a speck of blood. Even the cloud that's supposed to be the Val McClatchy photograph is in the wrong location. It's actually over a pool and not where the alleged crash occurred. The crash site is about 15 by 20 feet wide. That plane is 155 feet long, has a wingspan 125 feet. It has two enormous engines and a tail that stands 44 feet above the air. Somebody who believes that a Boeing 757 crashed in Shanksville is incompetent, in my opinion. This is ridiculous.
The entry wound in the ground and the wound in the ground at Shanksville indicates to me an inverted flight on a large aircraft that had one engine. The other engine was back about 4 or 5 miles or 1 or 2 miles behind. It was shot down.
Robin, I disagree with you 100%. There's a whole lot more that goes along with it. The claim that plane disappeared because it was in soft area that had been mined, it has a variation in which it disappears into an abandoned mine shaft. Well, we know what to do with planes with miners trapped in mine shafts. We bring out the bright lights and the heavy equipment and dig 24/7 in the hope that by some miracle someone might have survived. That was not done here even to recover the bodies. What could be more blatant, obvious evidence? They weren't digging for the bodies because there were no bodies and no plane to recover. They even trimmed the bushes and shrubs that had been burned so they couldn't be subjected to chemical analysis that would have determined they weren't burned by means of jet fuel. The whole of Shanksville is so absurd that I can't believe anyone would seriously come to a 9/11 teleconference and claim that a plane actually crashed there. I'm embarrassed.
Okay. I think we've exhausted this particular question as far as it's going to go tonight. Does anybody else have a question or comment for Jim regarding his presentation?
Ned Delaney?
Ned, go ahead.
I can't get specifics because it's been a while since I've read this. The information had come to me from some people down in Indianapolis that were working air traffic control that were told to be quiet about what it was they saw. But according to information that has circulated after 9/11, was that there was an aircraft that supposedly was involved in the events of 9/11 that was seen still in the air at some point, continuing on its normal flight path. And as to which one that was, like I say, this has been months and years since that information was being tossed around. But I know these guys were told to be quiet.
Well, that's consistent, of course, with Pilate's finding that 93 was still in the air, but it was over Champaign-Urbana after its alleged crash in Janesville, and that 175 was still in the air, but that it was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, long after its alleged crash. And no one's maintaining that a plane that was flown right into the air, into the ground, for example, couldn't exceed its speed limits. But what Robin said also is massively refuted by John Lear's affidavit in a lawsuit in New York City, which you can find on 911scholars.ning.com, which is the scholars forum. John has explained how that while the cruising speed of a 767 at 35,000 feet is in excess of 500 miles an hour, that it would be aerodynamically impossible at 700 to 1,000 feet. The air is three times denser. The turbines can't suck it through the engines. They begin functioning as brakes. He gives a very elaborate explanation, and I can assure you that John Lear's qualifications for making this assessment are overwhelmingly greater than those of Robin Horton.
Okay. Anybody else have a question or comment regarding Jim's presentation?
Yeah, Jim, this is Robin again, because I've done a little bit of study. First of all, you're talking about Indianapolis. That has nothing to do with the United 93, which is Cleveland.
I'm not talking about Indianapolis. I'm talking about New York. I was talking about New York. You were making a claim about the speed limits, and I'm explaining that John Lear has given a very authoritative explanation of why it's aerodynamically impossible for a 767 to have flown over 500 miles an hour at 700 to 1,000 feet altitude.
I think I'm trying to respond to the person's question. And the question he talked about was Indianapolis air traffic controllers being held to be mum. And, of course, all air traffic controllers recognized they were set up and they were going to be mum as a brotherhood. The aircraft that was allegedly seen to continue on is actually the track of American 77. Track and a target in the FAA world are two different things. The track is designed indeed to continue to proceed on its route of flight, basically, in search of the target associated with the track. But the transponder had turned off out in over eastern Ohio with Indianapolis Center, and the whereabouts of that aircraft was different. However, I will give you some information that I got from a European researcher who is even more deeply involved in radar issues. And what he has come up with is at the point that he saw where American 77 was lost to radar contact because of FAA very hackable parameters in a computer. The computer just didn't simply assign competent radar sites information to those to that area, but there were other FAA radar sites that were looking at it, and those radar reports were pulled out. And he this is not verified by me, I'm just giving you some information. He saw that the primary target of American 77 was intercepted by a group, and that the primary target of American 77 with that group turned off course and actually went to Wright Pat, and that the aircraft primary target that popped up over central West Virginia just simply popped up over central West Virginia from basically nowhere. So there's a lot of intrigue and whatever. So that's the answer to that I can give you as an air traffic control person still looking into the flight of American 77 based upon what I think you asked. I don't know if that's the case or not, but that's what I know or I'm working with right now.
Okay. Anybody else want to raise an issue or ask a question or make a comment? Hearing no requests. Oh, go ahead.
Who's Ken, this is Paul.
Yeah, Paul, go ahead.
I just want to say that for some reason or other, communication is very broken up now. I can almost not hear. I could understand up to about 10 minutes ago, even 5 minutes ago, but now it's very broken up.
Is anybody else experiencing a difficulty in hearing the communication?
Yeah, I'm hearing a little bit more, having a little more difficulty. Not so much when you're talking, Ken, but yeah, I had a little bit more trouble even hearing Paul.
Did you have trouble hearing Jim or Robin?
I didn't hear any of that. So what I'm going to do is I'm
going to... No, I know you didn't. I know you didn't, Paul. Paul, wait a minute. I'm trying to find out if anybody else is having the same problem. Did anybody else have trouble hearing Jim or Robin?
This is Ned. Everything's coming in fine here.
Okay. Well, it sounds like your problem, you're having the problem, Paul, but it doesn't sound like others are. I haven't had any problem hearing anybody.
Actually, I'm having more and more trouble hearing you, Ken, now. You're breaking up.
Really? Are you still hearing? You're still having problems hearing me, huh? Well, I think we lost somebody there. Well, maybe that was Paul, and he's going to call back, hopefully. That would be a good idea. Okay. Anybody else want to make a comment or ask a question? If not, Jim, would you care to kind of lead us in a discussion about future conferences following from Vancouver? Where do we go from here kind of thing?
Well, I think it would be great if we were to reach some kind of broad agreement, but I've seen resistance even from, you know, Kevin Ryan and Stephen Jones, who want to persist, and even Richard Gage to an extent, who want to persist with the myth of explosive nanothermite. That has been so thoroughly debunked that I find it very difficult to understand why they would continue to maintain it. When T. Mark Hightower and I first published a couple of articles about it, one of which was entitled, "Has Nanothermite Been Oversold to the 9/11 Community?" Another, and these were before the Toronto hearings, "Is 9/11 Truth Based Upon a False Theory?" We made it very obvious why the scientific literature did not substantiate the claims they had been making about the explosive character of nanothermite, including that it's a law of material science that it cannot be destroyed by an explosive unless it has a detonation velocity equal to or greater than the speed of sound in those materials. The speed of sound in concrete is 3,200 meters per second, and steel 6,100 meters per second, yet nanothermite has the highest ever attributed explosive velocity, detonation velocity for it is only 895 meters per second. So you can't get there from there. That doesn't mean that nanothermite may not have played a contributing role. I believe it was quite likely used to create those cookie cutter like cutouts on the sides of the facade, which when you examine them closely are actually physically inconsistent with the impacts of Boeing 767s, and where Richard Hall, in his quite brilliant work on a 3D radar study for Flight 175, even points out that beneath the initial smoke in the case of the North Tower, you can see a whole lot of little points of light that appear to be mini charges, or I submit possibly nanothermite creating that cutout. It's even increased in its dimensions after the smoke is cleared. The original impact points in the case of the North Tower actually create four points that form a Z after the smoke is cleared. It's an elongated V, but it's clearly not from a real plane where you wouldn't get this kind of, Wile E. Coyote type of consequence. Is that you, Robin?
Yeah, I'm sorry, that's Ken laughing. I thought that was an amusing comment.
Oh, okay, in agreement. Good. Now, I would be very good if they were to, concede the point that nanothermite can't possibly have been the principal cause. They now want to maintain they never claimed it, but Steve Jones told me personally in the lobby of a hotel in Los Angeles during the American Scholars Conference when I asked him, was he confident that nanothermite could perform these feats he was attributing to it? And I said specifically of pulverizing concrete and decimating steel, and he shook his head enthusiastically and said, oh, yes. So I know personally from the guy who is the foremost proponent of the nanothermite theory that was his possession in mid-2006, and I haven't seen a clear concession from those guys on, in relation to their admitting that they're wrong and that at most they could have played a secondary or subsidiary role, but can't possibly have been the primary cause of the destruction of the Twin Towers. Now, the Judy Wood gang, which actually turns out to have all the characteristics of a cult, they have a sacred text, they have dogmas, the Dew dogma, they have a sacred text where the towers go, they have a mythical leader, Judy Wood, they have unlimited fealty to Judy, and they act like rabid attack dogs for anyone who is remotely critical. Before the Vancouver hearings, I posted a 5-star review of her book complimenting her for bringing together such an impressive assembly of evidence that needs to be explained by an adequate theory of 9/11. Judy, as some of you are no doubt aware, insists she doesn't have a theory, even though the subtitle of her book is Evidence for Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. I did point out that in the portion of her book where she seeks to eliminate nukes as having been the cause, where she's quite successful in showing that it wasn't a collapse, and even that nanothermite can't have been responsible. But when in her discussion of nukes, she offers arguments that are completely correct in relation to maxi nukes, such as Dmitry Kolosov has proposed big nukes in the sub basements, where by his theory, the destruction of Building 7 would be just like that of 1 and 2 when they're completely different. But I point out that her arguments don't rule out mini or micro nukes, which was the version, you know, that received the most support, especially based on dust samples collected by the U.S. Geological Survey that include a whole host of elements, barium, strontium, uranium, tritium, and the like, that would only seemingly be effects of a nuclear event. But she and her followers have been, you know, to my utter astonishment, there are nearly 300 pages of comments, not on her book, on my review of her book. And of those 300 pages are like 3,000 comments now, 2,000 of them are followers of Judy Wood attacking me, which is completely ridiculous given all that I did in the lean days when no one would give her the time of day by featuring her on my radio programs 15 times. I published a chapter by her in the first book from scholars, The 9/11 Conspiracy, in 2007. I gave her 3 hours to speak in Madison, unprecedented. I don't think Einstein was ever given 3 hours to speak at an international conference. It's a national conference, of course. And I even invited her to speak in Vancouver, which, of course, she declined to do. She won't even communicate with me, but I find all this quite ridiculous. It's very analogous to when I organized the Madison Conference on the Science and Politics of 9/11. I invited Steve Jones and Kevin Ryan to speak. Steve did send a decline. Kevin never responded. Instead, they talked others representing their point of view into not coming, even after they'd already declared they were coming. They blackballed the conference. I wound up losing $10,000 on that because I had such a modest showing. I had about 100 people when I expected 3 or 4. And it should have happened. I have repeatedly sought to reach out to these other groups to bring us all together into a forum where we can discuss and debate our differences. I did that again in Vancouver. And
Jim, let me stop you there, because it sounds like the real question here is, how do we ever get a conference that will allow the 9/11 truth movement to emerge with some kind of working consensus? That seems to be the issue over and over again, and we seem to continually be thwarted in every single effort to do that.
I can only say that I wholeheartedly support it, and I would be glad to be a part of any such conference. That those are the kinds of conferences I have had, one nationally in Madison in 2007, one internationally in Vancouver in 2012. I have representatives of all points of view there, and, you know, that was the whole idea, to have open discussion and debate where we proceed in the rational fashion in accordance with scientific principles, which requires basing our reasoning on all the available relevant evidence. So I'm all for it, but, you know, you're going to have to get some concessions from other parties. This is what I've been doing my whole life. I mean, that's what I did in creating Scholars, was to bring together different points of view and experts in different disciplines.
Yeah. Anybody want to comment on this particular point? I think it's certainly possibly the most relevant question that we as a teleconference have tried to be discussing over the course of the last several years, and we seem to always arrive at the same frustrating results. Does anybody have any comment on this point?
This is Ned Delaney.
Yeah, Ned.
Well, the experience I've had in doing some attempts to communicate with various aspects of 9/11 groups that are associated with 9/11 is that there seem to be turf wars taking place, I mean, it's just repeat what I'm it,
repeat that.
Is.
I'm sorry. Jim, can you repeat that? I'm starting to get some problems hearing this, too. So just to let Paul know, I'm getting serious background interference. Is anybody else experiencing that, or is it just myself right now?
Just every once in a while.
I can hardly hear anything, to be honest.
Oh, boy.
I mean,
okay. Well, I'm sorry. Then continue your comment. We'll just try to go with it as long as we can, I guess.
Yeah.
Repeat what you said, though, please.
I sense that through some of the communications I've had and the responses that I've received and responses that I haven't received, for instance, Steve Woods being one of those individuals, is that there are people that seem to be tied into a turf war, that they're more worried about protecting their particular point of view than really dealing with 9/11 on the whole. And I'm getting a breakup here, too. So.
Okay. Well, listen, folks, let you know, Jim, before you came on the call, that Paul gave us a very revealing summary of a new book by Wayne Matson that I think you might care to listen to his summary about if you care to.
I hold Wayne Matson in high esteem. We know each other. I think he's excellent, and he's usually right.
Yeah, well, this had to do with Obama's parents' past with the CIA and all that. It's quite cutting edge. And anyway, I thought you might want to go back and listen to the first part of this call when you're given the as we always catch out the URL for the file, you know, the audio file. But anyway, I just want to let you know that that happened before you came on the call, and it was quite interesting.
That's good.
Yeah. So I think because of the technical problems tonight, that we should probably end the call here. People are just having a lot of trouble, but I do think that we've reached a point of discussion here that needs to be continued exactly on this question, because it's the one that we continue to revert to over and over again. How do we get consensus in the 9/11 community that allows us to work as a unified whole in a particular, you know, together? And I think Jim's recent experience in Vancouver is to the point, and it's certainly helpful to have had him give that firsthand testimony here for our benefit. And for our reference. Jim, thanks a lot for having joined the call twice, and please don't be a stranger if you ever feel you can make it any last Wednesday of the month to join us. So we appreciate your input any time. Okay?
Thanks. Well, I really appreciate your featuring me, and I'm very glad to be here, and I share your goals and objectives, and if there's any way I can contribute, you let me know.
We will do that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good night, all. We'll see you the last Wednesday of February for the next teleconference. And sorry about the technical issues. They do happen once in a while. Good night.